February 22nd at the Nimoy. The globally acclaimed Grenadian-Jamaican-American artist examines stuttering, justice, blackness, disabled speech, and divinity in this arresting reflection on the human experience. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
This is Ed Begley Jr., and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. And this week, it's the great poet and writer Audre Lorde. And we're bringing you an excerpt from the Pacifica Radio Archives with Audre Lorde from 1980.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumption or the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
On December 12, 1980, prize-winning poet and writer Audre Lorde gave a reading of her poetry and her prose. The reading was a benefit for the Women's Experimental Theater, and it was a gala and well-attended event. Audre Lorde talked and read from her poetry and from her inspiring new book, Cancer Journal. Claire Koss, who introduced Audre Lorde.
To name all of Audre Lorde's accomplishments would take the entire evening, and also the honors that she's received. But my favorite introduction is Audre's own words in a recent essay where she says, "I am black, lesbian, feminist, poet, mother of a daughter and son, and member of an interracial couple." She essentially goes on to say, "How many things can our society hate me for?" Audre lives on the front lines. She lives openly and charts forbidden and unknown terrains, and she empowers us with her courage. Her most recent battle with breast cancer, the terror, the pain, and the daily triumph, has become an impassioned and valued resource for women in the cancer journals, just published by Spinsters, Inc. Audre Lorde is an Amazon warrior who challenges each one of us by her choice to break silences, to survive, and to celebrate life. Audre Lorde.
I would like to open the reading with a poem that I feel is very timely, or that occurred to me, because it seems to say, for me, something that I need to be reminded of, and something that I think that most of us do, particularly in this time, when I think we all feel so much under siege for one reason or the other. And the title of this poem is A Song for Many Movements. Nobody wants to die on the way, caught between ghosts of whiteness and the real water. None of us wanted to leave our bones on the way to salvation. Three planets to the left a century of light years ago. Our spices were separate and particular, but our skins sing in complementary keys. At a quarter to eight meantime, we were telling the same stories over and over and over. But broken-down gods survive in the crevasses and mud pots of every beleaguered city, where it is obvious there are too many bodies to cast to the ovens or gallows, and our uses have become more important than our silence. After the fall, too many empty cases of blood to bury or burn, and there will be nobody left to listen. And our labor has become more important than our silence. Our labor is more important than our silence. I'd like to read some excerpts now from the Cancer Journals, which is a collection of prose. Let me tell you a little bit about how it came to be written. How it came to be written was, I have breast cancer, and after my mastectomy, I decided that while I was going through it and before I was making my decision, I looked for words, for other women's words that would give me a sense, not of what to do, but of another woman's experience. And I could not find them. I found books written by women that dealt with certain aspects, but not from the core. And certainly not any words from feminists, certainly no words from black feminists, and certainly no words from black lesbians. And I decided that it was about time, right? Some of it got aired. And also because it helped me. The book is really a collection. There are three essays and an introduction. And I would like to read a piece from the introduction and some from the last essay. Each woman responds to the crisis that breast cancer brings to her life out of a whole pattern, which is the design of who she is and how her life has been lived. The weave of her everyday existence is the training ground for how she handles crisis. I am a post-mastectomy woman who believes our feelings need voice in order to be recognized, respected, and of use. I do not wish my anger and pain and fear about cancer to fossilize into yet another silence, nor to rob me of whatever strength can lie at the core of this experience, openly acknowledged and examined. For other women of all ages, colors, and sexual identities who recognize that imposed silence about any area of our lives is a tool for separation and powerlessness, and for myself, I have tried to voice some of my feelings and thoughts about the travesty of prosthesis, the pain of amputation, the function of cancer in a profit economy, my confrontation with mortality, the strength of women loving, and the power and rewards of self-conscious living. Breast cancer and mastectomy are not unique experiences. They are ones shared by thousands of American women. Each of these women has a particular voice to be raised in what must become a female outcry against all preventable cancers, as well as against the secret fears that allow those cancers to flourish. May these words serve as encouragement for other women to speak and to act out of our experiences with cancer and with other threats of death. For silence has never bought us anything of worth. Most of all, may these words underline the possibilities of self-healing and the richness of living for all women. Now, there is a commonality of isolation and painful reassessment that is shared by all women with breast cancer, whether this commonality is recognized or not. It is not my intention to judge the woman who has chosen the path of prosthesis. Do you all know what I'm speaking of when I speak of prosthesis? Do you know what a prosthesis is? No. Prosthesis is a false breast. It's a falsie. And this is given to women right after breast cancer, and you're supposed to wear it and pretend that nothing has ever happened, right? supposed to be, that we are supposedly, what we're told is that we are as good as before. And this is absolutely accepted. Probably most women who've had mastectomies wear these things. It is not my intention to judge the woman who has chosen the path of prosthesis, of silence and invisibility, the woman who wishes to be, quote, the same as before. She has survived on another kind of courage, and she is not alone. Each of us struggles daily with the pressures of conformity, the loneliness of difference from which those choices seem to offer escape. I only know that these choices do not work for me, nor for other women who, not without fear, have survived cancer by scrutinizing its meaning within our lives and by attempting to integrate that crisis into useful strengths for change. I have learned a great deal in the 18 months since my mastectomy. My visions of a future I can create have been honed by the lessons of my limitations. Now I wish to give form with honesty and precision to the pain, faith, labor, and loving which this period of my life has translated into strength for me. Sometimes fear stalks me like another malignancy, sapping energy and power and attention from my work. A cold becomes sinister, a cough, lung cancer, a bruise, leukemia. But those fears I have found are most powerful when I do not give them voice, because close upon their heels comes a fury that I cannot shake them. I am learning to live beyond fear by living through it, and in the process, trying to learn to turn fury at my own limitations into a more creative energy. I realize that if I wait until I am no longer afraid to act, write, speak, be, then I'll be sending little messages on a Ouija board, cryptic complaints from the other side. When I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of vision, then it becomes less important whether or not I am unafraid. Because as women, we were all raised to fear. If I cannot banish fear completely, I can learn to count with it less. For then fear becomes not a tyrant against which I waste energy fighting, but a companion, not particularly desirable, but one whose knowledge can be useful. I write so much here about fear because in shaping this introduction to the cancer journals, I found fear laid across my hands like a steel bar. When I tried to examine the past 18 months, some of what I touched was molten despair and waves of mourning for my lost breast, for time, for the luxury of false power. Not only were these emotions difficult and painful to relive, but they were entwined with a terror that if I opened myself again to scrutiny, then I might also be opening myself to disease. But I had to remind myself that I had lived through it all already. I had known the pain, and I had survived. It only remained now for me to give it voice, to share it for use, that the pain not be wasted. Living a self-conscious life under the pressure of time, I work with the consciousness of death at my shoulder, not constantly, but often enough to leave a mark upon all of my life's decisions. And it does not matter whether this death comes next week, or 30 years from now, this consciousness gives my life another breath. It helps shape the words I speak, the ways I love, my politic of action, the strength of my vision, my purpose, and the depth of my appreciation for living. I would lie if I did not speak of loss. Any amputation is a physical and psychic reality that must be integrated into a sense of self. The absence of my breast is a recurrent sadness, but it is not one that dominates my life. I miss it, sometimes piercingly. When other one-breasted women hide behind the mask of prosthesis, I find little support in the broader female environment for my rejection of what feels like a cosmetic sham. But I believe that socially sanctioned prosthesis is merely another way of keeping women with breast cancer silent and separate from each other. For instance, what would happen if an army of one-breasted women descended upon Congress and demanded that the use of carcinogenic fat-stored hormones in beef feed be outlawed? You get that picture? I have found that battling despair does not mean closing my eyes to the enormity of the tasks of effecting change. Nor does it mean ignoring the strength and the barbarity of the forces which are aligned against us. It means, however, teaching, surviving, and fighting with the most important resource I have, myself. And it means taking joy in that battle. It means, for me, recognizing the enemy outside and the enemy within, and knowing that my work is part of a continuum of women's work, of reclaiming this earth and our power, and knowing that this work did not begin with my birth, nor will it end with my death. It means knowing within that continuum my life and my love and my work has particular power and meaning relative to others. It also means trout fishing on the Manisqua River at dawn and tasting the green silence and knowing that this beauty, too, is mine forever.
Audre Lorde talked and read from her poetry and from her inspiring new book, Cancer Journal.
I'm pleased and privileged to be introducing Audre Lorde to this benefit reading for the Women's Experimental Theater tonight. I remember about 5 years ago, the first time you came to a performance of Daughters, after which we invited the audience to stay and form a circle to name their matrilineage together. You said, "I am Audre, daughter of Linda, daughter of Ma Liz, daughter of a woman who lived on Knowles Hill. Daughter of Sebelisa, the mother of us all." Audre had been to visit Dahomey with her lover and son and daughter and was immersed in her research on African mythologies and goddesses, making accessible in her poems such names and concepts as Mawalisa, the sky goddess god, Yemanja, the mother of Orisha and goddess of oceans, Sebelisa, the mother of us all, and many others. In The Black Unicorn, these gods and goddesses of Dahomey and Nigeria cross paths with and connect with Staten Island and 125th Street, find refuge in poems of loving, and tear through violent images of black children being shot down and murdered by white policemen.
Can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine, just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear, you have done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now, you can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $10, $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. The site is kpfk.org, and there's a donate button. You are listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK, 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Kurt Elling. You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and on the World Wide Web at kpfk.org.
Night down, lady bright, in the arms of night.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris Ballen. And coming up next...
I'm Amy Gastelum. I am so excited to bring you a conversation between two thought leaders in our nationwide conversation about race and diversity. Ijeoma Oluo is a speaker and the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, So You Want to Talk About Race. Ruchika Tolshian is a writer and an expert on inclusive leadership. The two women are longtime friends and colleagues, so this chat is warm and it's funny and it's familiar. But it also invites the listener in as if to say, come on over here, sit by us. This conversation happened at a public event at Town Hall Seattle. It's about Tolshian's best-selling book, Inclusion on Purpose, An Intersectional Approach to Creating a Culture of Belonging at Work. To get us started, here's Ijeoma Oluo. Enjoy.
I would just love to know, like, why this book, you know, what kind of brought you into this space and what was your thinking as you were engaging, you know, in your research and writing for it?
This book is me making up for my follies and in some ways my sins of talking about gender diversity just as an issue that faced women. And when I said women, what I really meant, or whom I was centering by just saying women, were white women. And so this is my book. This is my learning in public, correct myself in public, and say, actually, if we really want to create an inclusive workplace, it's not good enough just to say women need to progress in the workplace. It's women of color and centering Black, Indigenous, and Latinx women. And that is really at the highest level what this book is about. The other thing that I want to talk about is how this statistic I read, which I think was life-changing for me, which is 3/4 of white people in America don't have a single friend of color, and 91% of the average white person's social network is white. And I think when I read that statistic, suddenly it's as if all the puzzle pieces of my life as an immigrant in America suddenly made sense. I was like, oh, that's why the majority of people I meet don't know what to do with me. They're like, okay, so you have a funny name and you say you grew up outside this country, but your English is very normal. I've been told that. And you can communicate with us, but you're also different. Like, there's this mental calculation that goes on, and it makes sense. It's because for a lot of, especially white people, they have never met someone who is different than them or really materially connected with someone who's different than them. And then the same study that I read at that time said that the first time for a lot of white people that they really
interact meaningfully with someone who's different than them racially is in the workplace. And it's literally like all the puzzle pieces fell together because, or fit together for me, because I've always been interested in the workplace. I've always been interested in leadership and management. I know that especially in capitalist societies, sadly, you know, businesses have an outsized impact on what happens, right, in our social lives. And, you know, even when we think about parental leave, I speak to women who get 20, 30, 40 weeks of paid, you know, maternity leave because they work for a high-tech firm. And then I speak to women who go back, you know, 1 in 4 mothers in America go back to work 10 days after giving birth, right? And they're not the ones working in the high-tech industry. And so we know that corporate employers have an outsized influence in how society operates and the experience of people. And so for me, those all those pieces really fell together. And as I started researching the book, researching for the book, speaking to women of color for their stories on the deep pain and trauma, I started finding healing within myself. I started finding healing for all those experiences, both in the workplace and outside the workplace, where I had really experienced marginalization, being overlooked, being underestimated. And I found healing in connecting with other women of color, centering as much as I possibly could underestimated women of color, and writing this book, knowing that there is a power in sharing our stories and moving the needle in the workplace and hopefully beyond.
That's beautiful. It's lovely. And to stay in kind of a personal space, when you were talking about, you know, how your earlier work kind of centered white women, I was imagining people looking at you and going, wait, what? How? What? Because you're not white. Visibly, you are not white. But I think that that's interesting because this is a thing we have talked about in the past, which is the immigrant experience as a person of color, especially a privileged immigrant experience, has layers that can often stop you from seeing your experience as a racialized one. Because there are so many other things. One, it can be your class that brought you here, that puts you in a space where you never had to consider the possibility of being seen outside of gender norms, but also all of the xenophobia and all of the other, you know, things that you do experience that everyone, especially people of color, experience when they come here that can seem like its own thing, not really related to race, even though I would say white men coming from France do not experience the same issues in a workspace that a woman of color would. And then there's also the ways in which we are not able to always keep in mind the ways in which our lives were shaped by white supremacy, even if we grew up in a majority place of color, right? So I'm a black woman who grew up, you know, born and raised in the U.S., but also my father was a Nigerian immigrant, and I have siblings who've just been here a few years, and I can see the difference in it and that disconnect. And a lot of it, when people talk to me and say, I don't feel connected to this struggle, I don't understand where my space is in it, a lot of it is because the ways in which white supremacy has shaped your life through colonialism,
yes,
through capitalism, has not been made as readily apparent, and the connections to how people of color are treated in this country haven't been made. And so it was interesting to watch as you became more aware of that, and we talked about your kind of understanding as not only you are a woman of color and you are treated as a woman of color, but still you have an abundance of privilege that shapes how you walk through the world. And I'm glad that you were coming to that awareness before you started writing this book, because I can see in how you centered people. Were there things in the research of this book, in your conversations with women who, and other people of color who had less privilege, that still continued to educate or surprise you in these discussions?
Oh my gosh, so much. And firstly, I just want to say that there is not an immigrant who comes to the United States and isn't in many subtle and overt ways told that your key to success is by upholding white supremacy and also upholding anti-blackness. There is not an immigrant. I mean, there is research that's shown that even immigrants who appear and present as black are told in subtle and overt ways, you know, the more you distance yourself from the black African-American community, the more you're going to be able to succeed and rise, right? And so I do want to name that because that is a big failing, I think, that a lot of immigrants with privilege in this country that we have, that we really have done quite a lot of damage in upholding a white supremacy and anti-blackness, and especially in our from our positions of privilege. So I absolutely want to name that. There was in a moment when I was writing this book, or that I was interviewing someone for this book or studying the research, that I wasn't not only educated but deeply moved. No, you know, women of color is an incomplete term, and we're certainly not a monolith. We have many, many different experiences. But the one commonality that researching and writing this book taught me is that there's this thread of being underestimated, of being overlooked, and the degrees to which and how quickly you come to that realization very much differs based on your identity. In fact, when I interviewed you for the book, what clicked into place for me is you said something along the lines of, there was not a moment that I came into the workplace and thought that I would belong or be treated properly or equally, right? Like, black women and black children are taught from a really young age, you live in a racist society and this is how you navigate. And something shifted in me because I was like, wow, because for me as an educated, college-educated brown woman, what I was taught is as long as you get all the education, you get all the experience, you start making money, of course people are going to treat you properly. Of course they're going to treat you equally. Race doesn't matter. And then that slow burn realization, no, it actually really does. Race and gender, that intersection really does matter. And that was a profound shift for me at when I spoke with you, and then I interviewed other black women that, you know, they didn't have that luxury, you know? You don't have that luxury of thinking you can do anything, you can achieve anything you want, and then realize, no, actually, you know, that's not the case. You know it from day one.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I've seen that, you know, and I used to have paid interns, and they were always young women of color, and a lot of them ended up being women of color who weren't black, and it was, they were always at that age where I would get this call a few months in, and they would be in tears because something profoundly racist happened in a space where they thought it would never happen. And recognizing, oh, you're at that age, you know, because it's not a thing that, you know, I mean, for me, it's my whole life, but I don't know if, I mean, I would say there's a real toll for the ways in which we are robbed of developmental stages, even, right? You are robbed of part of your childhood if your expressions of childhood are punished, and you don't get to go back at 30 and be a five-year-old learning risk and reward, right? But also, it's always been really weird for me to watch someone try to integrate an entire shift in how the world works at 25, 30, 40. You know, because white supremacy does a good job of hiding its animus and its exploitation of people of color who aren't black or native. And I would say part of it, they use the animus towards black and native populations in order to do that, because as long as you're not treated like that, you kind of feel safe in this middle space. But it's always been interesting for me to watch, and I'm always curious about it, because it's not, there's so much of the experience I can say, I know. That's not one. And then I wonder further, like, because the funny parts are the emails I get from white women, just devastated, you know, because they are 42 and they discovered racism is bad and it exists and they don't know what to do with themselves. And I'm just like,
Oh, you poor thing.
But also I wonder, like, oh, you know, you're going to have to make a choice now. Do you sit down your partner and your friends and have new expectations of them and set up all new relationships and give up watching those television shows you love and stop participating in the same harmful activities when everyone is expecting this of you? Or do you pretend like you never learned this lesson?
You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy. And that was the kind of story we love to highlight. Not just stories of what's going wrong. We like to bring you stories of activists telling you how they're standing up to injustice, and feminist artists and creatives who are making films and writing books about ways to make change in the world, different ways to see the world. Plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. So that's what we actually mean when we say at the top of the show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist, but also engage. And you can support us to keep doing that right now. You just go to kpfk.org, the website, and you click the donate button. And this is Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. And I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And we're proud to be on KPFK, along with a whole other host of varied voices from the community, but also varied perspectives, perspectives that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio dial, not in any of the kind of canned and already digested versions of news that you'll get anywhere else. But right here on KPFK, we're bringing you stories from our activism, from our lives, and from folks that we're excited to share with you. You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy.
Escucha Contragolpe. Programa que informa sobre lo que realmente impacta a nuestra sociedad. Hablamos sobre nuestra música, costumbres, identidad, historia y política. Con una tónica diferente, ligera e informal, buscamos despertar la conciencia y la reflexión mediante el combate a la farsa y el llamado balance informativo. Todos los miércoles de 9:30 a 10:30 de la noche.
Hi, this is Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and you are listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and for the world at www.kpfk.org. Support free speech and freeform radio. Peace.
Ijeoma Oluo is a speaker and the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, So You Want to Talk About Race. Ruchika Tolshian is a writer and an expert on inclusive leadership. That That was a conversation between Ijeoma Oluo and Ruchika Tolshian for Town Hall Seattle, two thought leaders in our nationwide conversation about race and diversity. Ijeoma Oluo is a speaker and the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, So You Want to Talk About Race. Ruchika Tolshian is a writer and an expert on inclusive leadership.
One thing I really like about this book is it's a piece that is so rooted in the direct words of women of color in a way that is very unambiguous. And it removes that option of people to pretend like maybe they didn't hear a thing. And I think in work environments, it's very easy to have someone come in, talk about race and racism, leave, and you can kind of pretend like you didn't hear anything they said. And especially the way they're set up, because they're often set up so that someone external comes in, talks about things that never fully connect to what's actually happening in a space, gives some surface-level recommendations that really just reduce HR complaints, and leaves. And then people can be like, oh, yeah. And this book has a lot of very firsthand experience and practical advice in it that makes it hard for people to go, well, okay, but, you know, what if we all just had a chat instead, you know, and didn't do these things? And I'm grateful for that. And I wanted to ask, because I do see some questions coming up around this too, and it's just such a hot topic, right? Everyone talks about DEI right now. Right. And before people became scared of critical race theory, they were terrified of DEI. And I will say, you have a lot more to be afraid of from critical race theory than DEI. DEI can't even scare racists. In the critique, there's a lot that is very valid. And I think there's a lot that people don't understand. And a lot of anger around it is very misplaced, some of it purposefully so. But I was curious if, like, in looking at, you know, the work you've done and trying to be very, I'm saying practical, not in a sense of void of emotion, because I actually think the lived experience and understanding lived experience of people of color is one of the most practical things you can do, but practical in the sense of actionable. In trying to do actionable work while also having been in many spaces that are seeking to do what people know as DEI work, what are some of the gaps do you hope that this book can fill?
Great question. And, you know, Ijeoma, one of the difficulties actually in conceptualizing this book in my head, you know, at least 5 years ago, before actually the murder of George Floyd, at a time where diversity, equity, and inclusion essentially meant gender diversity, white women's progress, etc. And my hope was, you know, I can hopefully change the conversation around that, you know, say there's extreme value in using the words diversity, equity, and inclusion correctly and centering that work correctly and taking it out of this check the box idea. And not that many people are talking about it in a very meaningful way. And I was really, you know, I was very hopeful that, okay, this book, the timing is right and it's going to come out and hopefully people will engage with it. And then the movement for racial justice happened, certainly sparked off by George Floyd's murder. Very, very important movement. And suddenly everyone was talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. It was overnight I saw LinkedIn profiles change to inclusion strategist and diversity guru and equity, whatever it is. And I fear that in many ways, and, you know, I think hearing your question, in many ways, I worry that the work has really been diluted, right, of what it actually, what the essence of it is. Like, what does it actually mean to have a diverse workforce that is made up of people who have largely been underestimated and underrepresented and overlooked? Not how many, you know, different types of white men do you have, right? What does it mean to center equity? Which it'll always be a process. It's not an outcome. You're looking at barriers and how to remove them. You're looking at inclusion again of people who have not been included in the workplace. You're not asking again five white women whether they are enjoying their experience and they like coming to work. And so my hope with this book is, even though it's become a hot topic, my hope is that people will also see the other side of how profound and meaningful this work can be if we do it together and we do it correctly. If we center anti-racism in diversity, equity, inclusion efforts. What gives me hope and what makes me optimistic is, until 2 years ago, when I was asked to speak at an organization, I was told, could you please not talk about race? And can you please not mention, you know, racism? When you talk, we just want to talk about diversity. And of course, I would say no, but I would get those requests. And now, you know, I don't know whether it's just because people feel scared to say that to me anymore or something has shifted, but I feel like at least there's some acknowledgement, much more than ever before, of the way that racism is really built into all of our systems and how we're navigating it.
I'm going to give you a tip that you didn't ask for, which is, because I get things like this all the time, absolutely take those gigs, because once that contract's signed,
and the money's wired
in. It doesn't even matter if the money's wired in. It's actually better if they try to not pay you. Very few companies, racist as they may be, are foolish enough to say, you talked about racism, we're not going to pay the brown person that we came in to talk about inclusion. I have literally had this happen. I actually had a talk that people still walk up to me about, for a certain government organization that wanted me to speak for Dr. Martin Luther King Day and asked me not to bring up a certain youth jail. And I was like, cool. So now I'm only talking about a youth jail. And what are you going to do? That was silly. You should have never said anything. Because it was only going to be a sentence before, and now it's like paragraphs. So always take it. They will pay you. They weren't going to ask you back anyways. And then you get to say the thing that the white person they would have moved on to wasn't going to say.
No.
So take the money and then do the thing anyway. That's
I'm
my
getting so
tip.
Much out of this. This is so good.
You know, it's so funny too, because people are like, you probably shouldn't say that out loud. People won't call you. No, they don't listen to my talks. You're going to call me and be like, don't talk about this thing. You've never heard of me before in your life. Somebody who hates you told you to call me. And that's on you, because you didn't Google it.
Which, by the way, happens all the
time. It does.
And with the levity, I want to acknowledge, like, as women of color, like, you could be a New York Times bestseller, right? And you could be on Trevor Noah. I mean, you don't need a list of Ijeoma's accomplishments. And yet there will always be those moments that remind you, you know, don't dream too high. Mm-hmm. You know, remember, you're still working in our system. You should be more grateful we gave you this opportunity.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, and we were sort of talking about this earlier, because there's a veneer to it. You know, part of the reason why I started doing this work was the realization that there was no, you know, when I was working in corporate spaces, there was no promotion, no amount of financial security that was ever going to buy me the freedom to enter any mixed race space fully as a black woman and be safe and seen and heard and appreciated. That was never going to happen. And in fact, the opposite was going to happen. Mm-hmm. The more that people, quote unquote, gave me, no matter how hard I worked for it, the more I was going to be expected to play along, and the more I'd have to lose. And I just decided, well, I can either blow this up at 30 or I can blow this up at 60. It's all about how much of my own time I want to waste. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, quit my job, said I don't want to sell trucks anymore, and started writing full time. But the funny thing is even when you're doing this work, even if your name is rising in doing this work, it still happens. It's like, it's not, you don't actually, all the behind the scenes is just as toxic. It's still just as exploitative. The only difference is I don't get fired for saying the things that I wanted to say for a long, but there's still things you don't say, right? Yeah. You don't talk about your publisher. you don't talk
unless
about
you're backstage. These little,
yeah, unless you're backstage. And so it's an interesting space, and you still don't get comfortable.
No.
And part of how you navigate it is by the relationships you
yes.
have and how you get through even doing this work. And I think a lot of times there's this idea that people of color who do any work around race or ethnicity live in this space where, one, we like talking about it all the time, which we don't. But also, oh, well, I'm sure you don't encounter the racism then. Like, who's going to be racist to you? They know who you are. Like, everyone. Everyone.
Literally everyone.
Everyone.
Literally.
And it's so ingrained in society.
It really is.
What keeps you going? And because I know that a lot of times when I talk with other people, like, there are regular body blows of just like, oh, come on. Here, too. I just want to do this thing. That can be really discouraging when you're doing the work. And you do a lot of work, right? So you're not just the author of this book. You're mm-hmm. also a teacher, mm-hmm. a speaker, an educator. And what keeps you going in this work?
I hope it doesn't sound trite, but it's because I have a 5-year-old brown boy who's going to grow up in America. Oh, who is growing up in America and is American. And just the way the experience I had when I said to my mom during one, birthday party where my friend called me the night before and she said, I can't come to your birthday party. My mom said, I can't come to your birthday party because you're Indian. That's going to happen to my son as well. And I don't want that to continue on. I'm truly fighting for a world where I don't know if I can prevent it, right? I don't know if I can prevent it. He's already 5. But really for as much as I possibly can, for our kids, right? Mm-hmm. That's really what keeps me motivated. That's what keeps me going. Because otherwise it is so hard to do this work.
That's beautiful, and I think a wonderful way to end this talk. And I'm so proud of you, and this is wonderful, and I know that y'all will love this book, and I'm just really glad it's out there in the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you to all of you. Thank you.
I'm Amy Gastelum. This is Making Contact. That was a conversation between Ijeoma Oluo and Ruchika Tolshian for Town Hall Seattle. I listened to Tolshian's book, Inclusion on Purpose, while I was working in my garden, and I did not use headphones. It was blasting through a speaker, so my neighbors heard it too. I have to tell you, the book includes real stories from women of color about their experiences of exclusion and bias in the workplace. But it also offers practical, actionable ideas for organizational leaders so that they can make change. Get into it.
Support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button or call 818-985-5735. So during this fund drive, we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air. providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times, and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. That whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine, and that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA. But we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening, to keep going, and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer, and that is amazing to keep KPFK sustainable. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. And all through this past lockdown and pandemic, we have all kept going remotely for you. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. And speaking of love, we love getting feedback from listeners about the show. We've been getting great feedback on our programming during this fund drive. And, you know, like Mothers of the Revolution we covered recently, and somebody wrote in saying that seeing that movie about the anti-nuke movement reminded her how she got involved in activism and then moved into climate justice. It's part of an ongoing wave of being part of making change. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
Let's see what happens. Hey, what's up? It's Christian James Hand. I'm just a music fan, and I'm sitting in the KPFK studios, and I'm wondering if why you're listening to KPFK right now, and you haven't called 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Why, if you're listening, are you not supporting? Radio is the last live medium in the universe. If you don't support this, it goes away. And why would you listen to radio promoted by Coca-Cola, etc., etc., when you could be listening to people-powered radio by people that care about what they're doing, have a passion for the music, have a passion for the subject matter? It's not made for the general public. It's made for people that care. So if you care, then you got to care about what you care about. And if you care about what you care about, then you have no choice but to pick up the phone and support people-powered radio. Because the other solution is computer-powered radio. And computer-powered radio is not radio.
Your call is important to us. Please press hash to continue. Your call is important to us. Your call is important to us.
That's computers.
That's computers.
That's computers. This is real people making real radio about things that they really care about. And I care about that. And if you do too, simple. 818-985-5735. Why wouldn't you do it? You wouldn't do it if you were a... All right. Does that work?